Welcome to What's Up Conversations, a podcast with icons and legends of the video game industry. In this episode, my guest is the writer of many incredible story-driven games. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Mikhail Zegar, the writer of such games like The Chronicles of Riddick, Escape from Butcher Bay, The Darkness, The Chronicles of Riddick, Assault on Dark Athena, Battlefield 3, 4, and 1. In this episode, we talk about the behind the scenes of those games, techniques of writing for video games, and a huge unannounced open world game from Avalanche Studios that got cancelled. Please subscribe, share, and like with some conversations on YouTube or on all the major podcast streaming services. You can follow me from the link in the description or from www.nikufarmusic.com. Alright, let's get into it. Let's start this. Hello and welcome to What's Up Conversations, Mikhail. How's it going on?
Thank you. Hey, I'm good. How are you?
Perfect. Thank you so much. It's really something special for me to have you on the podcast, as you've worked on so many of my favorite games. So it's really something for me. Yeah. So let's go back and talk about your breakthrough to the game industry. How did you end up writing for games? And was it something you always wanted to do? And tell me about the early days.
I wanted to, when I was a kid, I wanted to either make video games or draw comics. So I had, but I never thought that would eventually happen. So the way into this business has been quite long for me. I did a few years of studies. I went to film school and studied like literature and creative writing and things like that for a couple of years, way back. And then after high school, I started a company with a high school friend that we were running for a couple of years. And during that time, during the high school years and also those years running that company, I got to know a couple of people that eventually started the Starbreeze company up in the north of Sweden. So I knew these guys since way back. And when they moved down to Uppsala and started the pre-production on what was to be the first Riddick game, they contacted me and asked me if I wanted to join them. So that's how I ended up starting to write for video games.
Yeah, you were the writer at Starbreeze Studios, a studio that I liked a lot back when they were focused on the story-driven games, but now I think they are a completely different studio. I think part of the reason is the migration of the core team to machine games. And interestingly, I think machine games now has the feeling and the spirit of the Riddick and Darkness era of that company. Am I right? Mm-hmm. And what do you think about the sudden change of direction for making story-driven games to mostly online competitive games?
You mean for Starbreeze?
Yep.
Yeah. I haven't been at that company for ages, so I have not seen I don't think I know very few people working there nowadays. As you said, the original founders of Starbreeze, or the core team that I worked with on both the two Riddick games and the Darkness games, they have pretty much everyone of them has left, and most of them are at machine games. And those people I'm still in touch with a couple of them. So I know their way of working very well. So they took their mentality and way of constructing games with them when they left for machine games. So that is why you see the later games coming out from machine games are more in the spirit of the early Starbreeze games. So I cannot really attest to what has been going on at Starbreeze the last, I don't know, what is it, 5, 6, 7, 8 years or something like that.
Yeah.
I've been doing app.
Let's talk about The Chronicles of Riddick, Escape from Butcher Bay. This is a
very rare game that was based on a movie, but ended up being better than the movie. I was 13 when I played that game, and instantly became one of the best games I'd ever played. Digital Foundry was playing the game recently, and they were talking about the visual of that game. I was amazed by the artistry and the technicality of that game. It still holds up. Mm-hmm. But I guess the important factor of that game was the atmosphere of the Butcher Bay. This story, in my opinion, was way better than the movie. The depth of the characters, the favors you had to do for others, the connection you had to make between people, and mix it with a thrilling kind of thief-like stealth. It was one hell of a game. Tell me about the project. How did it begin? What was it like to working on a licensed project, and what were the important factors for you writing that game?
Well, when I started working, or when we started working on the game, it wasn't even a movie tie-in. It was because there were no one at Starbreeze knew about. I don't know even if there even was an early script for the Chronicles of Riddick movie at that point. So what we were doing was something based on the previous movie, the Pitch Black movie, yeah. Exactly. So if you go out on YouTube, you can find a playthrough of an early prototype that we did. Maybe, I don't know if you've seen it, but that prototype is called Pitch Black, and we did some exploration to prove to the publisher that we could do a game in that style. The game that Starbreeze had made prior to the Riddick game was Enclave, which was a third-person action game, and the publisher wanted us. The original pitch was about a third-person game which was set in a prison environment with some GTA-style gameplay, so that was the game when I started. But pretty early on, the team decided that we were going to try to push for something different and make it a first-person game, and also try to incorporate things that we liked in the other games, like this, games like Thief and Deus Ex and other games. So we pushed pretty hard for that, and the publisher was a bit nervous about it because the studio hadn't done anything like that prior. So we were given the opportunity and made the first prototype, which was pretty much hacked together on top of the old Enclave engine. And we tried out the mix of stealth and the adventuring part, trying out some simple puzzles. But it was a really good learning experience because we figured out a number of things, like how hard should the puzzles be, how much hand-holding do the player needs and stuff like that. And also a lot of design things about how the scale of the environment and all those things. And in parallel with that, the lead programmer, Magnus, was experimenting with rendering technology and did some tests. And we tried to figure out how much visual fidelity could the engine handle. So we, during the course of the game, we had to do a lot of creative things to work around the limitations of that technology. So it looked and still looks pretty spectacular, but it came with a huge cost. So I don't think you ever see more than 4 or 5 characters on the screen at the same time, for instance. So and that is kind of hard.
Doesn't
to pull
feel
off.
Like that.
Exactly. So that we did a large number of tricks to get the feeling that you always have people around you, but you never actually see more people on the screen at the same time. So, but during the course of the development, it became apparent that there was a movie coming out. So we got to see a script for the Chronicles of Riddick movie and got tied up with Vin Diesel and his crew at Tygon. And then things started to, that put a whole new level of constraints on the project, because suddenly we had more of a world, like a franchised world, to take into account. And that was a lot of fun. It was some struggle, and also we were given a lot of our ideas were incorporated into that world. We got some ideas from Tygon and Vin Diesel. The whole eye shine sequence, for example, where you actually get the eye shine job, that was, I don't think that was part of the story from the beginning, but that was something we wrote in to tie it better into the movie, and all those things about we had no idea what a Furion was when we started making the game, so that was something that we learned along the way. So, and that was challenging to work with an IP like that, because there was like the communication with the owners of the franchise. We didn't have direct access to David Tu and Vin Diesel because they were so busy working on the movie. So we had people in the middle that dealt with the communication. So it could take a long time sometimes to get feedback. So we did something with a milestone, sent it off, and sometimes it took weeks. Or maybe even longer to get feedback, and it was really good feedback. But at times we felt that okay, this is good feedback, but it's coming too late. So we had to like maneuver around that. So it was a bit of a challenge, but it came out good in the end, though.
Yeah, Universal was behind the movie version of Riddick, right?
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Way better. I mean, Pitch Black and Riddick became a cult classic of the movies, but the game is also a new standard. It was awesome. So after the Riddick, you went to write for a game that is on my top five list of favorite games of all the time, and it was The Darkness, based on the comic series by Top Cow. And just like Riddick, I believe the game was way more better than the comic. Let me tell you why I think the story of Darkness is one of the best stories ever told in video game history, and I'm going to tell it with an example, right? It's Jackie's 21st birthday. His uncle betrayed him. They're looking for him to kill him. A demonic force is awakening within him. He knows that his life has changed, and at the end of the day, he visits the love of his life, right? The only person that matters to him is her girlfriend, Jenny. In a game that you shoot mafia members in the streets of New York with the help of demonic forces, the game suddenly pauses to spend time with your love. You visit Jenny's apartment, blow up the candles, and a dialogue option appear that it says, "Tell her that you love her." The player chooses it, and Jackie says, "Jenny." Jenny answers back, "What?" And Jackie says, quote, "Nothing," unquote. I mean, wow. Jackie loves her, but also he knows if he says, "I love you," the connection with him is going to be stronger. What if he dies? I mean, what if he drags her to this new life? Jackie is having a second thoughts about this relationship, not because he doesn't love her, because he loves her so much. And this was just a small example of the entire game. It was a masterpiece of storytelling mixed with fun and innovative gameplay. Please tell me everything about working on that game, the story experience of working on The Darkness.
The Darkness experience for me was, and for the team, was very different from Riddick, because we had it was still working on an IP. So we took another people's work and trying to make that into something new. But what we did early on was to hire Paul Jenkins, even before that, when the opportunity to make the Darkness game came to us, we started by making sure that we got hold of every single issue of the comic. Yeah, And I didn't know the comic that well. I knew a little bit about other similar comics, like I can't remember the name of that comic now. Oh, never mind. So we sat down and read through all the comics, and we found that the quality of the writing was best in the ones that were written by a guy called Paul Jenkins. And we felt that, okay, we want to work with that guy. We knew that we wanted to have someone external to work with for the writing process. So we contacted Paul Jenkins, and he was on really good terms with the owners of the franchise. So as soon as he was on board, we could do pretty much what we wanted. If Paul Jenkins was okay with it, the owners of the franchise was okay with it. So that made things much, much, much easier in terms of communication and like moving forward. So we could write the game and make it happen in a much smoother way. There were other types of challenges with that game, though. So what we did was we flew. Paul was situated in the UK, I think. Yeah. So he flew in, and no, he was living in the States at the time. Yeah, but I think he's originally from the UK. Nevertheless, he came to Uppsala and spent something like 1 or 2 weeks with him, the core team, with him in the room, and we laid out the whole game, pretty much the whole game story, in terms of what locations would you visit, what are the like main story beats, like the night when you get possessed by that demonic force, for example, and also when you get betrayed by your uncle, and the moment that you described with Jenny, all those important story moments were written during those 2 first weeks in that room. So we laid out pretty much the whole game at that point, and made a map of like the whole of New York, and make sure that that we were going to know exactly what was going to go into the game. So the group that worked with that was people from all of the disciplines of the game. So we had like the lead gameplay designer, we had the lead level designer, the lead scripter, the lead programmer, me as the lead writer, and so forth. So all disciplines were able to communicate what they thought was important. For example, the level designers, if they knew that, okay, you want to have a level that takes place in a butchery, for example, then we can do this and that, and we can make it look like this, and they show pictures, and we were like working back and forth. Technical limitations were brought to the table, and so we got a really good start laying out the basic premises of the game. So from there on, it was, to simplify it, was more or less about filling in the blanks, like what happens in detail during the whole game. Of course, some things changed, and we were like throwing things around a little bit, and I think we cut one or two small sequences and added a little bit of other parts. So it was not a totally smooth ride in any respect, but it was great, and one of the reasons, as I said, was because we had Paul on board, so it was really smooth workings in terms of the writing. So that was great.
Yeah, and comparing the game to the comic is so grounded and emotional and kind of realistic. But the comic, I kind of feel like it's mythical. It's very bigger than a personal story. So how did Top Cow kind of approach you about this big change in the comic and the game?
They did not have any real issue with that. We were quite open from the beginning that we wanted to make a more mature, like adult version of that universe, and they were totally on board with that. But it was the thing that we were thinking about initially. So the first thing that we saw about the Darkness game, or a Darkness game, was a pitch that was presented to us, to Starbreeze. And that pitch was very different from the we started to make later on, but it still had some of the elements, and it was much more comic-like. I think it was a third-person game as well, much more comic in style, more like maybe compared to like a game like Arkham Asylum or something like that. It still had the gameplay elements that you like sneak into shadows and do the stealth thing and so forth. But we liked a lot of what we saw in the comics when we were reading them, but we felt that we wanted to make it much more real. So what we did was to make our own pitch and try to present that. And Tokkau and others liked it, and then we started working. And one of the first things that we did was to create a sort of prototype level where we tried to prove all these things by making sure that we got the right visuals in place, some of the more risky mechanics in place, where you become a shadow and sneak around. There were some concerns about how to deal with the darklings that you spawn. Like how are they supposed to work? Do we have AI that could make them work in a good way and so forth? So it was a lot of, and also the storytelling aspect, and like we were working on a different kind of dialogue system. I don't know if you thought about that, but or noticed that, but there is a huge difference in how the dialogues in Riddick and Darkness work technically. So in Riddick, for example, you when you want to communicate with an NPC, you walk up to them and you press a button. So it's you as a player who initiates all dialogue, and that works pretty well. It's just like a standard way of doing it, but we wanted to make it more a less mechanical way of interacting with NPCs. One way of blurring the limits between like seeing something happening in the world and then suddenly being in sort of a mini game or whatever you want to call the dialogue. We made it so that all the NPCs had a radius around them so they could sense that you were getting in close proximity, and then they called for your attention, or they could do that at least. And you walk up to them and they start the conversation. So it becomes much more of a cinematic feel and much more smooth. So you blend the transition between being in normal gameplay and being in dialogue by doing that. And that had a number of challenges and posed other kinds of limitations to how we were supposed to write them. And the amount of dialogue that we needed to write for each NPC were much, much higher for Darkness than in the Riddick game, for example. Because we needed to have, like, if you walk away in the middle of a dialogue, we needed to have some sort of way to respond to that and so forth. So it was a lot of, we did a lot of experimentation and innovation in terms of the mechanics of the storytelling as well between those games.
Yeah, thinking about it, I remember there were some numbers scattered around the city that you could find and call the number via a payphone, and they would answer. And there was this little stories everywhere. Tell me about those stories, those phone calls.
Well, that came out because we wanted to make the world a living and breathing place. We tried to do that in Riddick as well, but it's much more limiting when you're in a prison environment. So one way of sprinkling sort of a little bit of world information in Riddick was the cigarette packs that you could collect, for example, and we threw in a lot of fun stuff in there. And then you could walk up to doors and eavesdrop on conversations and so forth. But in darkness, since we were in a big city, we felt that, okay, we can do much, much more here. So the idea came, I can't remember who came up with the idea of the phone calls, but the idea came to, well, how should we do that? Like, because we can't make an open world. So you can't have it that a player could walk into like any apartment and start listening to what's going on. So we were limited to the number of places that you could actually visit, but we could put up payphones and make sure that you could interact with them. And that from somewhere around there, the idea came to sprinkle out the phone numbers and then we had an opportunity to just fill the game with VO content, which is fairly cheap. You could fit a lot of VO content on a disc. It's a matter of recording and making sure that everything gets into the right place. So it's not easily done, but it's still comparing it to making videos and movies and stuff like that. We had a lot of those as well. You could turn on TVs as well in the game and watch.
You could watch movies. A whole To Kill a Mockingbird in that film. The entire film.
Yeah.
As crazy.
Yes.
And if you stayed on the couch with Jenny enough, this trophy would unlock. Like, you spend time more than usual.
Yeah, so we had a lot with that. I can't remember if I think it's some there. I think there's some dev voices in there as well. I remember when we did Riddick, towards the end of a project, there are days when you're waiting for bug reports and stuff like that, so you could have a couple of hours waiting for things to show up. And then it's a good thing to have things like cigarette packs to draw or make. So a lot of fun and crazy stuff were done during the end of Riddick. And the same thing with Darkness, like sprinkling the game with the little secrets and fun stuff.
Yeah. So I've heard that the Darkness didn't.
Good.
Yeah. Heard that the Darkness didn't sell as much as it should have, but because 2K didn't make enough copy of that game. Is it true?
I don't know about that, actually. I think it sold all right, and it's been out for on a number of platforms, but I'm not sure. You probably have to talk with some of the producers for the game too.
It's backwards compatible right now on Xbox platforms. I encourage people to go and play that masterpiece. And it looks amazing even right now. So have you played the second one? Made by Digital Extremes.
I haven't played it. I've seen it and I've seen playthroughs of it. But I know pretty much nothing about the production of that game. It was a totally different company that made it. So
yeah, I played the game, didn't like it.
They came into the... They came into the sort of like a similar situation that we did, that they suddenly had to take into account our work to like continue the building that IP. We did take some liberties, so there are some differences between the story in the comics and the story in the game. I think Uncle Paulie, I don't think he was the same character in the comics. We did some changes with that. I remember. I can't remember exactly what the changes were, but it was for a more dramatic story.
Yeah. So I'm curious about the process of writing a game like The Darkness. When you have a plot and a certain beat points, and also you have gameplay mechanism. You also mentioned something about a level design. I wanted to work out a level in a butcher shop, and it was interesting. Mm. Did they approach you like, "Hey, I want to work on this part of the city and make something up about this and this story"? So how do you make sure that your story is exactly what you wanted, and meanwhile, it's dynamic enough to work well with other section of the game?
Well, the thing is that writing for video games is a hugely collaborative process, and you iterate as well. So that is why, for me, it's always important when I have been writing to be sitting with the team. So we usually have a number of writers on each project. On the Riddick, we had three writers, and there were other people that did some minor writing as well. And on Darkness, we were also three writers. And on the Battlefield games I've been working on, it's been more than that. So, but to me, it has always been important to sit with the team and be close to them, and they should know that I exist and I'm working on the story, so they can come up to me and. With ideas and suggestions, and because you feed off each other's work. So for instance, if a level designer has an idea about like we wanted to have like a huge Zeppelin crash in this level, or just making something up, they could come and talk to me, and I could take that information with me when I talk to the other writers, and we can see, okay, this is really cool because it would fit perfectly with whatever we are working on for that level. Or we could go back to the level designers and say, hey, this is a really good idea, but we thought it would be even better if we move that thing that you are thinking about to this location instead, and or whatever. So it's a constant back and forth. And also when you start building the game, you start... trying to like draw up the broad strokes to get the sense of like how long does it take to move through a level, for example. So you don't know exactly how much time you have, which can create a problem. For instance, if you have say that you have some critical information that you need to convey to the player about the gameplay goal, say that you need to say to the player that your goal is to reach this place and you should kill all those enemies. And you need a certain amount of words to convey that information, and that will take a little bit of time. And then you have a choice, or you need to make a choice. Either you lock the player down so you have the time to convey that information, or if you know that, okay, the player is going to work through to work his way through these corridors, for example, and there are some places where you can't move very fast through there, so. If we put up a megaphone in that corridor and have that megaphone give that information to you during the walk, we could make it much more of an interactive experience. But in order to do that, you need to know how long it takes for the player to move through that location. So it's a lot of work and a lot of things that you don't know from the get-go. Things that appear during the production. And sometimes you can go to a level designer and say that, oh, this corridor that you have here, do you plan to have like an enemy encounter there, or could we make sure that the player sticks there for, say, half a minute or 2 minutes or something like that? Yeah, I can have the player like go through a series of environment puzzles. So you have to like climb a few boxes and find the way out. So I can definitely make sure that you have to stick around for 2 minutes, and then we open the door so he can get out. Or he says to me that, no, I was thinking about having an encounter in there. All right. And then I have to go back in and rethink a little bit of what I'm doing for that level. So I think it's to make a really good interactive storytelling experience pretty much requires that you have close collaboration between all disciplines in the game.
Yeah. So there's this unique way of storytelling in Riddick and Darkness that main characters express their feelings with monologues with a very subtle tone, and it helps a lot to understand them. with the darkness, it even goes deeper in loadings, and Jackie talks to himself about past, future, and his feelings. The closest thing I experienced like that after these two games were the new Wolfensteins by Machine Games. Tell me about these monologues.
Well, for one of the things that we knew was that we needed to have some sort of loading screens in both of these games. In Riddick, we try to mask them as much as possible by having huge doors that you go through, and you freeze the screen for a bit. But those also give some opportunity to play some VO. But in the darkness, we wanted to take that a bit further. So that was one of the technical challenges, because we did not have the technology to play video during loading when we started the project. So that was a research project for a couple of programmers to make sure that we could pull that off. And that is also one of the reasons why you do early prototype, to make sure that you know, like, how long is the loading time going to be. So you try to test that out. And as soon as you know that, you know, okay, we need to fill this, because loading is really boring. You don't want to like sit on a screen that says just loading. So we felt that this is a really good opportunity that we should not miss. So we need to make sure that we do some kind of storytelling here. And the easiest way of doing storytelling there is to have a couple of screens with text that sort of tell a backstory. So you can have mission objectives, or you can have some parts of the world building like presented there. Or you could have that or voice, but we went a little bit further with the videos and made sure that we had written enough monologues for Jackie to pull that off. And also to have monologues that we had enough monologues so it didn't feel repetitive. Because some sections of the game you do revisit quite a lot. So we have the subway stations, for example, where you revisit a lot, because they are sort of hubs to get through the city. So there is a fair amount of loading. So we needed quite a lot of loading screens to make sure that the player were not bored or heard the same thing over and over and over again. So that was the thinking behind that.
Yeah. So after The Darkness, you worked on a sequel to the Riddick, Assault on Dark Athena. Another great game and a worthy sequel. How did that happen?
It started out because there was plans to do a port of the original Riddick game to the 360, I think it was. And in doing that, we felt that we and the publisher felt that we wanted to give the players a little bit more, not just the same game. We had done some extras that were included in the PC version of the Riddick game. You had the developer commentaries and I think it was one or two small extra bits of story that were included in the game. The whole when you play the Riot Guard towards the end. I don't think that was part of the first version of the game. I think we were adding that for the PC version. But so when the port to the 360 came, when those talks began, we were trying to figure out ways to something new for the player. Like, what should that be? We started writing and designing a kind of a smallish extra adventure that was supposed to be, I can't remember exactly how long, but maybe 3 hours or 2-3 hours or so. That was the Dark Athena campaign. So that was originally meant to be just an extra on that disc. But as we moved along, it grew. So after a while, it was decided that this was going to be its own game. But at that time, I had actually left Starbase, so I was working on the first part of it, and we were part of writing that story. So after I left, they continued working on that and extended the story. So there's a story beat. I think it's maybe halfway through that game that was supposed to be the original ending of that campaign, and then it continues after that. And I think that if you know that, you can probably feel that there's something happening there, like in the arc of the storytelling. So it's always tricky to both remove too much of a story and also to like extend a lot into a story to get like a shift in the story beats and like the pacing and so forth. So that was how it happened as I remember it.
Do you think they're ever going to make another Riddick game?
I have no idea, actually. I know that Machine Games are busy working on an Indiana Jones game right now. So they just,
crazy.
Yeah, they just announced it a couple of days ago. So that is going to be spectacular, I'm sure. So I don't know. I know that when the Chronicles of Riddick movie were made, they had David Chewie and Vin Diesel. They had, I think they had plans for more than one movie. I think they were thinking about like a trilogy or something like that.
Yeah, another kind of reboot one came, I think, in 2013 or 2012. Yeah, yes. It was called Riddick. Yeah.
Exactly. So, but I think that because it didn't do that well, the first movie, the Chronicles of Riddick movie. So I don't think they got the opportunity to make what they originally intended, but then came back to the character later on, as you say, with that last Riddick movie. So, but you never know. There's a mobile Riddick game done by some Swedish studio. I haven't seen that game, so I don't know how it is, but it came out a couple of years ago. So there, I wouldn't be surprised if there will be more Riddick games or more Riddick movies for that matter.
Yeah, we need a Riddick game, we need a Thief game, and we need a new DSX game. And no one's making them. Yeah. So,
you never know.
Oh, yeah. So, tell me about your departure from Starbreeze. What happened?
Well, it wasn't more than I had been. I was living in Stockholm during my whole time at Starbreeze, and Starbreeze is located in Uppsala, so I was commuting back and forth. And then I started a family here in Stockholm, and after a while, I felt that it was a bit too much to travel that far for work. So I just quit that job and. My original idea was to start working as a freelancer or a consultant, but I was offered a position at Avalanche Studios just a couple of days later. So I started working there as a lead designer and game director for a big game that were canceled a year and a half later during the Lehman Brothers collapse, the economic collapse. Back then, so it was just a matter of like my personal situation was I was kind of fed up with traveling too much. It's much nicer to have your work within half an hour than like an hour and a half. So it makes a huge difference, especially if you have people at home that depend on you, like picking up on daycare and stuff like that. So.
Hey, can you tell me about that Avalanche game? A year and a half working on a game and suddenly nothing.
Yeah,
it
was not fun. I think they had to let more than half of the studio go overnight because of the economic collapse. So it was the publisher they canceled all their games except one, I think. So and that it was a big publisher. But we had been working on this awesome open world game set in an alternate reality version of the 1950s, sort of.
It was
insane. We had a huge 8x8 kilometer version of London running that looked spectacular, but and we didn't have skyscrapers, but we had like inverted heights, so the city grew downwards towards the bottom of like down into the ground, and was like you could fly zeppelins and airships and so forth and planes and or jump down into these really really deep holes in the middle of the city. So it was visually and world building wise it was spectacular, and it had some really fun gameplay ideas and so forth. But it was a long. It would have been a long production. All the Avalanche games had gone through pretty long productions because they are so vast. So I would not expect that game to have. We would need to put in at least a year and a half more to make that game happen. Like in total, 3 or maybe even 4 years to make it to finish it. So, but it was tough. It wasn't fun at all to let that go.
That's a great idea, man. I really want to play that game. What happens when there's this awesome idea and suddenly a developer is having problems financially or whatever? What happens to that? I mean, it's gone. Nobody wants to make it.
Yeah, the thing is that I think that what happens is that all of the assets and all of that material gets tied up in the legal black hole somewhere. So of course I do still have screenshots and some design documents and stuff like that lying around, which is great for reference and to look through and to get like how did we solve this or that and so forth. So it's a lot of know-how that gets lost unless you try to hold on to it in some way. But of course the whole It's not possible it's probably sitting on a hard drive in a cupboard somewhere. The whole game, I'm sure.
That's a shame. So after the Riddick, you started a new chapter working on one of my favorite franchises, Battlefield. Tell me about working on Battlefield 3 and 4. How did they happen, and what was your point of view as a narrative designer on those games?
I wasn't a narrative designer on those two. I was hired to Battlefield 3 to work with the narrative. It was unclear at that point exactly what I was supposed to do, but they had the lead designer was also writing the game. And we had an external other writer that we worked with, and a couple of the multiplayer part of that game had some writers doing stuff as well. So I came in, I was hired to, or contracted to help out with that game, and they had come pretty far into production at the point. So they had a couple of levels that were working, and they had a story idea, and then we started to dig through that material and try to figure out how do we tell a coherent story here. And one of the problems that we faced during that production was that some of the games, the original idea of the storytelling for that game was to tell the experience of war from a different number of perspectives. So you had like the mission where you were a pilot, and you had the mission where you were commanding a tank, and other missions you were like running in the streets, shooting. So it was a mix, and you play different characters throughout all these missions. So one of the challenges was to try to tie that into something that was coherent and told an overarching story. It was really tough to do. Mainly, I think, because the order of levels were shifting around quite a lot, at least for not towards the end so much, but at the beginning when I was working the first couple of, I think it was a half a year or a year or so, the order of the levels were shifting around to get the right pace, gameplay pace. So that posed a lot of challenges on how to like stitch the game together and not lose all those threads. And then I think it was some cuts that happened pretty late, and we very, very late in the production, we tried to, we felt that it was pretty much impossible to follow the threads as a player just by playing through all those games. There were some aspects of the story that were sprinkled through the games, but since we had thrown things around so much, it was almost impossible to follow what was going on. So what we came up with was that idea of having this interrogation in between the levels, where you had one character that was interrogated by some CIA agents about some events that had taken place. And he was retelling the story from his perspective, and you got to see what he was retelling from other points of view. So that made it possible to follow those threads, even though it's still quite hard to actually follow what actually happens in the game. And that was the best we could come up with. And then towards the end, you actually play that character. You go from, there was an idea we had pretty early on that we should have these as movies in between the other sections. But at some point we wanted to break out of the movie and make that interactive and make that into gameplay. So that was a plan we had from the beginning for those sequences, and that it was what we made. So you shoot your way out from that and escape from that interrogation sequence to because the character figures out that something bad is going to happen in New York where you sit right at the moment. So you grab a gun and you run out and try to stop this terrorist attack that is happening as the movie takes place.
Yeah. And I believe Battlefield 1 has the best story between all the entries of the franchise. It was a very emotional game, and the integration of the story and the gameplay was so on point. I was working on the an emotional World War One game.
It was great. It was very different. All the Battlefield games has been very different for me. I've been working on three of them. Battlefield 3 was about working on existing material, trying to stitch that together help stitch that together as I just mentioned. Battlefield 4, we started from pretty much a blank slate and tried to create something from scratch. And Battlefield 1 started as a pet project between Stefan and Martin, two guys in the team. They are World War One buffs, and they had been throwing around ideas about making a World War One game for, I think, years before the production started, and had gathered a lot of material and so forth. So when I was contacted by Stefan and he started showing me what they had in mind, I showed a lot of cool movies and gameplay ideas and things that they had been working on. And at that point, they also had had a fair amount of material written. So when I came, my role was not to lead the writing in any way. I was more supportive and trying to take what was written for the game and look at it from a gameplay perspective or a game/narrative perspective and see like what can we do to make sure that we incorporate this in the game in the best way possible. So it was very different from the other games.
It was kind of a combination of short stories. The story.
The
game was kind of like a combination of a couple of short stories about different soldiers, and the writing must have been completely different than the things you've done in the past.
Yes, and that is like Stephen Hall, who was doing the bulk of the, where he was the main writer for all the main storyline things. We hadn't worked with him before, so he brought his tone and his way of telling things, and he had a lot of crazy and fun ideas about things. So unfortunately, some of the more quirky and fun stuff, things that we that was written had to be cut for technical reasons, but still he had a really good way of approaching the writing he's a novelist really, but he's been doing a lot of game writing since. I think he wrote the Battlefield 5 story as well. It was a pleasure working with him, and I learned a lot about writing from that process. So it was, again, it was a bit of a back and forth, because he was not on site, so he was delivering things to us from where he was sitting, and we took that and tried to make sure that it could be implemented, and sometimes we had to cut things and throw things around and change things. And then we sent back the updated script to him, and during the call he was like, "Oh, what in God's name have you done here? Don't you see that you have like ruined everything?" And we were like, "Oh, we had to do this, but this is important. You cannot ruin this important thing that I have stitched throughout these scenes." And then we tried to work with him to get that back and find. So it was sort of back and forth with both with him and with the rest of the team. So it was great.
Yeah,
I love that. I love that kind of way of working.
All right. So what's in the future for Mikhail? What are you working on right now?
I'm currently in between projects. I did a small project during almost a year ago, or last summer, end of last summer, or early last summer, I finished it. It was a smallish online game that was made by an advertising studio here in Stockholm. But it was a couple of months' work, and I think it came out all right. So that was the latest thing I've been working on. Like for higher work, but other than that, I've been busy writing on a couple of side projects that I've been doing for my own. So that is what I'm doing currently. But I'm in talks with a big studio here in Stockholm, and hopefully, I will start working with them on a big unannounced project next week or so. We'll see.
Oh, next week is going to be announced, right?
Sorry, what? Say again?
Yeah, we got cut off. I mean, is it going to be announced next week? Or are you going to start working on it?
No. Yeah, it's not going to be announced next week. It's probably a year away or something like that. I'm not sure, but and I don't. I had the first talk with them 2 days ago. So we're in the middle of figuring out how I can help. Awesome. And how that is going to work out. So I haven't signed a contract yet, but hopefully that will be sorted out and I can start work. It's quite a few people that I have been working with previously and that I really enjoy working with. So I hope that happens, because the project looks spectacular and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Amazing. So Mikhail, I guess this conversation is a good proof of how much I love your work and how important your games are for me. Thank you for writing emotional, immersive stories, and thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.